It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here as we wrap up 10 years of Security Now, our 520th episode. And you know what? There's only more news, not less. There's Firefox updates and issues, Flash updates and issues. We will talk a little bit about his decision to stop using NoScript and start using Sandboxy. A lot of feedback on that. It's going to be a great jam-packed episode. Stay tuned. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 520, recorded Tuesday, August 11th, 2015. The Quest for Surfing Safety. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you and your loved ones and their privacy online. And this is the man to do it, the man of the hour, the man of the day, the man of the week, the man of the year, Mr. Stephen Tiberius Gibson.
And thankfully, you cannot keep that up for the next 2 hours.
It starts with a G, and that rhymes with V, and that stands for virus. He is the creator of SpinRite, world's best hard drive utility, but also the first guy to discover spyware and write an anti-spyware tool, and he's had his own run-ins with the bad guys, so he has a lot to say about security. And I think until you get the Steve Gibson seal of approval, there are many, many people in this world who say, you know, I'm not going to trust that. I want to hear from Steve. And this is where you do it each and every week. You doing good?
So we've got some Black Hat follow-up as expected, but there's just so much news that I thought, you know, this is another one of those where we, you know, news has to take first priority. So fear not, everybody who's been submitting your questions to the mailbag, hopefully next week we will do a Q&A, but I wanted to mostly do a news catch-up this week just because there's so much to talk about, but also my declaration last week that I was considering, well, and that I had actually disabled NoScript. Oh, that caused quite a flurry of reaction among our listeners. And then there was a rare but true 0-day flaw discovered in Firefox, whose nature demonstrated that even putting Firefox in a sandbox wasn't protection. So I've spent some time brainstorming, and I want to wrap up today's news catch-up with the title of the podcast, which is The Quest for Surfing Safety.
Good.
Because I'm on the quest, and I have an idea. But essentially, I've arrived at where I think I have to be. I'll share a little bit about what my browsing around the net has found so far, and maybe our listeners will be able to nail this down based on some of the constraints that I have and help me find the right solution. So I think a lot of fun for us. So I want to talk about stage fright and how that's evolving, the Android exploit that we've now mentioned the last several weeks.
Yeah, and we talked on the new screensavers about it, which was great on Saturday. And that was when the Zimperium tester had first come out. And you pointed out that Lookout has one, too. And I keep running it on all my phones, including a brand new Moto G that just came out. None of them are safe.
Right. Since we last spoke, what I was hoping would happen has happened. And that is, we have not one, but two free freely downloadable testers for the stage fright problem. One from the guys Zimperium, who originally found these six exploitable, zero day. Well, actually, they weren't zero day. They were. He did a static code analysis and found, I think it was more like 12 problems, six of which could be leveraged into remote code exploits. That was going to be, well, it was the topic for his presentation at Black Hat this past week. And what happened was they became zero days technically because they were discovered in the wild. So their plan was initially to wait until August 24th to release the proof of concept, unless they were discovered in the wild, which they have been, and have now been incorporated into some exploit kits. So what we have now, as you mentioned, Leo, are two freely downloadable test apps. And I have a link in the show notes. It's odd that it's not easy to find on their site. I had to go back in my Firefox browsing history and search that in order to find the page where they have a zip file containing 10 MP4s, which if you send them to someone, I mean like or to yourself, will demonstrate. These are their proof of concept files. They're, so it's an MP4, a multimedia file, which demonstrates the each of these various flaws. So not only can you use the testers, and what's interesting is that initially there was some disagreement between the two. Zimperium's required three different types of privileges, which put some people off because the one from Lookout didn't require any privileges. Also, it seemed that I'm trying to remember which way it went. The Zimperium one was still complaining about vulnerabilities in patched phones when the Lookout one said, oh, you're patched now. You don't have anything to worry about. However, Zimperium re-released theirs. And I have a Samsung Galaxy 4, I think it is. Three out of the six tests show green for these are okay, whereas the other three show red. So that gives you a lot more granularity than the Lookout app, which just says, okay, everything's fine, but doesn't demonstrate explicit responses. And as I understand it, Zimperium's test is actually sending your phone or maybe their app some specific tests which it verifies. So although it kind of got off to a rocky start, may ultimately be the better of the tests, but we now have them. And as I said, that's what I was really hoping for. And we've also had some movement in the industry. Samsung has said that they're going to now be doing monthly patches. And I don't know exactly what that means, but that's really what we need. As I've been saying, the smartphone industry has been really neglecting the fact that these are computers.
Samsung, LG, and Google have all agreed to do monthly patches.
Great. And you know, and as I said to you when we were talking about this on the new screensavers on Saturday, cars are in the same category now. I mean, essentially what everyone has to get is that whether it's a doorbell or a thermostat or a car or a smartphone, these are computers. They have computers in them. And no one thinks that they have any security vulnerabilities when they ship these or they would fix them. But everyone is always finding security vulnerabilities. That's just, I mean, no one wants to believe it. But look at the history. You know, we're wrapping up 10 years of this podcast, and we've got so much to talk about that we don't have time for a Q&A because there's just so many problems.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. You know, it's not getting better. It's getting worse. So what I think, it just has to be recognized that there are going to be problems. People, anyone doing a computer-based device has to put their hubris to the side and say, you know, and build in from the beginning the ability to fix this somehow on the fly. If the device is connected to the internet, that puts it in danger, then it can be connected to some sort of an update facility to do secure fixes. Even if they don't think they're ever going to use it, I'll bet you they'll be glad they built that in.
Yeah. There is, you know, Google says we're using address space randomization, ASLR.
Glad you mentioned that.
In all versions of Android since, I think, 4.0.
Right.
What does that do?
The proper way to put that is it makes it more difficult. It does not end the problem because we are constantly seeing ASLR bypasses. So yes, it makes the exploit more difficult, but far from impossible, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So yes, that's a good mitigation, but it's not something you can rely on. We really, you know, we want this. You don't want your phone to be able to crash if it receives an MMS message. Because as we know, crashes evolve into exploits. And boy, this is a target-rich environment when you talk about 950 million devices. And the problem is many of those are still never going to get fixed that are vulnerable. You know, the earlier versions of this, they're still in use.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big issue because, I mean, there's just so many phones out there that are never going to be patched. And so ASLR only makes it harder. It doesn't mitigate it.
Well, yeah, it mitigates it, but it doesn't foreclose the possibility.
My understanding, you correct me, my understanding would be because the address space is randomized, while you could probably crash a phone with 4.0 or later, it would be very hard to have code jump to memory and execute, which is what you'd want to do to exploit it, right?
I would say it's trickier.
Not impossible.
Not impossible because, again, like for the last several years, I mean, you know, Windows has had ASLR now for many
versions.
But it's
not on by default, and most people don't turn it on because it breaks code. A lot of people put code in data.
No, you're confusing that with DEP, Data Execution Prevention.
That's right, I am. Okay.
DEP is the one that they've sort of turned on softly, or they only turn on for their own things that they are secure.
Right. That's executable code compatible in the data space. This just randomizes memory locations.
Yeah, and maybe theirs is better. I have not looked at it closely. So maybe Android's ASLR is for some reason able to do is more difficult to defeat, but it's being defeated in Windows and Mac all the time.
Okay.
So it ups the ante.
Good to know.
And essentially you just want these things fixed. You know, it's better to fix them rather than hope that, you know, somebody won't guess right. And because typically, for example, they're able to randomize the boundaries of the libraries to like one of 256 positions, but not a million positions,
right?
Just one of 256.
Right.
So, you know, if it crashes 255 out of 256 phones, but you've got a target space of 950 million, then you've still got, you know, several million phones that just by shooting them blind are going to take over some of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say yes. It's good that makes it more difficult, but there are still ways to bypass ASLR. It's just more work.
Mm-hmm.
So on the Windows 10 privacy side, we've got some updates. It was inevitable that somebody would create an app. And so there's an app for that. It's on GitHub called Disable Win Tracking. And it does four different things. So it's open source and it's been evolving. It's at version 1.5 now as it's being fine tuned. And the author states that he intends to add features to it as I said, as we sort of learn more about Windows 10. And so it's sort of a simple to run app. It's written in Python. And so you can, if you've already got Python installed and one other requirement, there's an additional library it requires, then you could just run the Python script in order to make it go. But there is a self-contained executable that includes the Python runtime bound into the XE. So that's probably easier for most people to use. Anyway, so it allows you to turn off what they call their telemetry services, which is sort of the background, how are you using Windows, what are you doing stuff. So that's one option. You can either delete or disable the tracking services. There's radio buttons where you can choose to delete or disable. And I would just be happy with disabling for what it's worth. There are two services, one called Diagnostics Tracking Service, and one called DMWAP Push Service, which is a WAP push messaging routing service. And I don't know, I don't think it makes sense to delete them. I think, you know, disabling them, you know, people are disabling Windows services all the time. They stay disabled. So I would just say people ought to disable them so they could, if there was some need to re-enable them in the future, you could. And you can disable logging that is enabled by certain trackers. Anyway, so a few features which are very simple to disable using checkboxes. And I imagine we'll see similar things like this in the future. So I did want to mention that. Also, remember the people, there was a huge breach of, I think it was 13 plus emails that escaped. And a service was produced called isleaked.com. And isleaked.com, you could put your email address in and it would just do a search to tell you whether that email address was among those that were leaked in this massive breach. These guys did a very nice kind of walkthrough guide. And so their domain is fix10.isleaked.com. Which is sort of a summary of what you and I walked through with our listeners last week, Leo. And by the way, we got a huge number.
People loved
of
that. Yeah,
very positive tweets, feedback from last week's, you know, walk through the privacy settings. And so, fix10.isleaked.com.
This is screenshots of all the stuff we talked about, basically.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So it's sort of basically screenshots and, you know, red circles around you want to set this switch to this and this switch to that. So and maybe for people who are, you know, who want some additional information. Again, this is unfortunately there's enough issue with Windows 10 privacy that we're seeing lots of articles and sites and now apps that are suggesting here's how you can do this. Also, people were very concerned about whether TrueCrypt was cracked, because the website that I love to hate, theregister.co.uk.
Yeah, you know, I saw that and I thought Steve will want to talk about this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it is significant that not one other site, tech or otherwise, quote, picked up on the story, unquote. And so you know, the register.co.uk's headline was, wait, what? TrueCrypt decrypted by FBI to nab docs dealing sysadmin. And so and their subtitle was, do the feds know something we don't about crypto tool, or did bloke squeal his password?
You get so, you got a choice there. One of them seems more likely than the other.
Yeah. So they say, you know, the first paragraph says, discontinued on-the-fly disk encryption utility TrueCrypt was unable to keep out the FBI in the case of a U.S. government techie who stole copies of classified military documents. How the feds broke into the IT bod's encrypted TrueCrypt partition isn't clear.
Uh-huh.
It raises questions about the somewhat sinister situation surrounding the software team's sudden decision to stop working on the popular project last May. Oh, Lord. Well, okay, there's nothing sinister about it. And, you know, what one thing we know about TrueCrypt is that the sole vulnerability in this or any other password-based system is how good is your password? And if your password is not good, there are tools that can do brute force decryption of a password. We know that. And as far as we know, TrueCrypt has survived two audits that have looked closely at the way it implemented its crypto, and nothing was found wanting. So this, you know, this is either, yes, he gave away his password, or someone had applied a brute force cracking tool. There's no doubt that the FBI has access to a brute force cracking tool for TrueCrypt. And we have covered many stories where people used good passwords, and there was one that that I remember only because it involved several nations. It was like it was the intelligence or law enforcement in Brazil absolutely had to get data from a TrueCrypt protected drive, and they sent it to the U.S. FBI after they failed to be able to get into it, and our FBI couldn't either because the person used a good password. That's all you have to do. So
it doesn't even have to be like that good, just pretty good. I wouldn't think it'd be enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'll come back to this topic of Firefox vulnerability later, but I did want to make sure everyone knew that they needed to at least update to 39.0.3 with some level of urgency, but not house on fire, but 4 was just released this morning. So, version 4.0 just released this morning. So first of all, the vulnerability that was fixed in 39.0.3, I think I was at 39 when this happened. And so they were doing some incrementals in the meantime. Here's what happened, though, which is what is a little bit chilling. First of all, we almost never discover any actual vulnerabilities in Firefox. Typically, it's in add-ons, you know, like Java or Flash that are running in Firefox. And of course, we talk about add-ons for controlling those, most notably NoScript. So a security researcher, Cody Cruz is his name, discovered that a malicious advertisement on a Russian news site was exploiting a previously unknown, so this was a zero-day vulnerability in Firefox's built-in PDF viewer. It was able to essentially breach the same origin policy. The same origin policy is another thing we've talked about a lot. That is probably the single most significant security firewall that all browsers enforce, which says, if a page comes from Amazon.com, script which is running in that origin, that is the idea is that if the HTML which contains JavaScript, that is, as we know, executable code, but that executable code is unable to access anything other than from Amazon.com. It specifically can't just go out and do other things because that would represent a serious security problem. So individual origins, the origin being like www.amazon.com, code loaded from Amazon.com is restricted to that same origin, to only reading and writing things within that same origin. Well, it turns out that there was a way that the code in Firefox's PDF viewer could allow a origin breach, a same origin breach, which allowed some script which was provided by this ad to access the system's local file system. So essentially, it got in this case, the cross origin wasn't to a different internet site. It was to the local file system. That JavaScript then it searched through, I was going to say ransacked, the local site looking for subversion files, S3 browser files, FileZilla, and libpurple config files on Windows systems. And on Linux systems, it looked for global configuration files in the slash etc. directory, as well as bash history, MySQL history, PG SQL history, and SSH files, and any other files with pass or access in their names, and shell scripts. And if found, and of course, Linux systems would typically have lots of those, it would upload those to a server in the Ukraine, or in Ukraine. And it left no trace on the host or the target system, the vulnerable system, the victim, that this had happened. So Mozilla responded immediately after Cody's report. This was not ever seen widespread. It was, he discovered it, he reported it, they fixed it. So only people who happened to use a version of Firefox that had the PDF viewer in it were vulnerable. Only Windows and Linux were initially known to be vulnerable. Although in a later update to their posting on the Mozilla blog, they noted that they had seen Mac then being targeted. A version of the payload was also looking for those sorts of files with Mac file names. And also trying to export those. So I guess really the only problem would be somebody who wasn't updating Firefox, who still had an older version of Firefox and happened to go to a site that was serving an ad that was leveraging this problem. This was immediately fixed, like in hours. And I saw people, congratulating Mozilla on the speed with which this was addressed. So you want to make sure you've got at least 39.0.3. And what's interesting is that my proposed solution, that is for running Firefox in a sandbox, would not have prevented this problem, because Sandboxy prevents system alteration, but doesn't prevent the browser from reading from the system if it wants to. So that gave me some pause and sent me on a search for another solution, which is what we'll talk about later in this podcast. Meanwhile, we've gone to version 4.0.40 of Firefox, which is with not huge changes. Largely, they're billing this as an appearance and usability improvement for Windows 10. So it more closely matches the Windows 10 UI. It's easier to use on a touchscreen. They like increase the size of the close buttons on the tabs to make them easier to touch. The address bar uses a larger font. They've improved some of the graphics for smoother scrolling and animation. Some small security improvements, but nothing huge. Better warnings for unsigned browser extensions. And it's worth noting that when they go to the next major release, version 41, they are going to completely block unsigned browser extensions. So, you know, I'm sure that browser extension authors are going to be are already aware of the fact that their extensions will not be permitted to operate with the next major version of Firefox. So Firefox moves forward.
Somebody's saying, and I don't know if this is true in our chat room, that you could do this in about config with the earlier version of Firefox by disabling the battery. About config, DOM battery enabled, change to false.
And that would do what? That would block non-sign. Yeah, I'm not aware of that.
So but is boy, the battery API not the issue?
Maybe, yeah, I don't know how the battery...
Maybe he misunderstood the conversation. Should never... I'm sorry I interrupted. Continue on, please.
No problem.
Sorry about that.
Time for your sponsor note.
And okay. We said we'd do the Mozilla thing.
We have the garbage truck
perfect
beeping,
timing.
So it's perfect timing.
You stop talking. I'll start advertising. And then when the garbage truck leaves, you can pick it back up. I hardly think of this as an advertisement because it's guys I know and really like, and they're doing a product that many of you really can use. I'm talking about IT Pro TV. Tim Broom and Don Pezet were IT trainers. They helped people get their certs so they could get better jobs, perfect their IT skills, that kind of thing. They saw Twit and a light bulb went off. They said, wait a minute. What if we did something like Twit, you know, live broadcasting of IT training that you would then be saved so you'd have a whole big course library? And what if we did that hours every week? Pretty soon that library would be full of great stuff. And you know what? It happened. They've been with us for more than a year, and I'm very proud to say that it's been a really great kind of partnership. We don't cover this kind of detailed stuff. I mean, I think watching this show, for instance, is probably very valuable for your, and I know a lot of IT folks do watch, very valuable for your skills. But if you're going out to get the A plus or the CCNA or the Security Plus or the MCSA or the MCSE or that kind of thing, there's exams. You gotta prep for the exams, and that's what IT Pro TV does so incredibly well. Are you interested in getting a great job in IT? Are you working on IT? Or maybe you're just curious and you just like learning this stuff and you want something even more in-depth than the things we do here on Twit. Visit itpro.tv/security now. Browse around and you can see all the great things. But there's so many benefits. You can watch it on your tablet. There's an iOS app. There's a Roku app now. And the iOS app and Roku app talk to each other so you can watch it on your big screen TV. Then head out and launch it on your iPad, and it picks up where you left off. They've, of course, got Android playback as well. They have a virtual machine sandbox lab environment. So if you're studying Microsoft Server, for instance, all you need is an HTML5 browser, and you'll be able to get in there and hands-on practice and everything. You could use it to do it on a Chromebook. The Measure Up practice exams are included with your subscription, so you can see how ready you are to take the exam before you take the exam. Courses in virtually everything, including Linux, Windows, and OS X desktop support. Really handy stuff. Go watch the guided tour at IT Pro TV. Check in and watch them live on the air. Yeah, because they're live. They do 50 hours a week. Two studios. You can see the program guide right there, and you can even watch for free if you want. They have a basic plan that lets you watch live
All this week and next, they're recording new courses on Microsoft Exchange Server 2013 and the CompTIA A+ exam. And you can just watch that starting at 9:30 in the morning Eastern time. There's a good series of free videos on their blog covering new features in Windows 10. That's free. It'll also give you an idea of how great the instructors are and the information is. And just like Twit, you can chat along with the live stuff. It's really fantastic. I want you to try it out. Go to itpro.tv/security now. When you use the offer code SN30, you can try it free for 7 days, and you will receive 30% off if you subscribe, which brings it down to less than $40 a month for everything, $399 for the entire year. And that 30% off is good for the life of your account. itpro.tv/security now. There's corporate and group pricing available if you call them. Clients include Harvard, MIT, UCSD. I'm so proud of these guys. Stanford. They did this all in the last couple of years. It's mind-boggling. And there's always new stuff. Daily updates, new features monthly. And you'll like this. When you take the exam, you pass the exam, and you're done, it's easy to cancel. You're not stuck in there. They're really great. Check out the Sean Philip Oriano's Ethical Hacker and Hacking Forensics Investigator and Crypto courses. Those are great just for fun, as well as getting your CEH cert. itpro.tv/security now. Don't forget the offer code SN30 for free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account. itpro.tv. We love them. Love you, Tim and Don. And I'm really proud of them. They have made an amazing business out of that. And it's just really great to see that. Garbage trucks are gone.
Yes, perfect timing.
They've moved on.
I was on with Father Robert before Black Hat, and he had Mark Smith on, who enjoys going to Black Hat, and was talking about how great it is to be there. And, you know, I was sort of, and you and I have talked about this too, that my sense is, yes, I mean, it's an experience, but everything that happens is posted online.
Right.
And you have the problem of being there that many times the four things that you want to see are all happening at the same time.
Robert said the same thing, actually. Yeah.
Right. And anyway, I got a kick out of this retweet. Our friend Matthew Green, the Johns Hopkins famous cryptographer, retweeted a tweet from Thomas Patchick, who's one of the founders of Matasano Security, we've spoken of often. And he tweeted, "There is nothing you will learn at Black Hat or DEF CON that you won't learn quicker online."
Wow.
And I thought, well, there's two security gurus who are in agreement with the fact that, yeah, I mean, it's I get it that going to the conference, what you're the whole experience is the whole hacker ethic sort of thing. And it's like, yeah, okay. You know, I mean, I guess in the same way that I'm really not a gamer, but I like looking at the technology of the games. Similarly, I'm not into the hacker meme. I like the technology of, you know, of the security issues. And so I think that really is my focus. So yeah. I'm happy that it's all online.
In fact, some of it came back with video too, so we'll have a lot of coverage on
shows
coming up.
Good, good.
Yeah.
So there was this one really interesting. I couldn't wait to see what was going to become of this Black Hat presentation titled "The Memory Sinkhole." And the abstract wins the hyperbole award of the year. The title was "The Memory Sinkhole, Unleashing an x86 Design Flaw Allowing Universal Privilege Escalation."
Oh.
And oh, I know.
Wait a minute. It's x86. Like, that means everything.
Yeah. It's like what we've had since the mid-1990s.
What?
And they said in x86, beyond Ring Zero lie the more privileged realms of execution, where our code is invisible to AV. We have unfettered access to hardware and can trivially preempt and modify the operating system.
Jiminy.
The architecture has heaped layers upon layers of protections on these negative rings. But 40 years of x86 evolution have left a labyrinth of forgotten backdoors into the ultra-privileged modes. Lost in this Byzantine maze of decades-old architecture, improvements, and patches, there lies a design flaw that's gone unnoticed for 20 years.
The way you're reading this makes me think, no.
In one of the most bizarre and complex. He gets that right. The most bizarre and complex vulnerabilities we've ever seen. We'll release proof of concept code exploiting the vast unexplored wasteland of forgotten x86 features to demonstrate how to jump malicious code from the paltry Ring Zero into the deepest, darkest realms of the processor. Best of all, we'll do it with an architectural zero day. Yes, it's also a zero day built into the silicon itself, directly against a uniquely vulnerable string of code running on every single system. So it involves SMM. And you may think, what? Is that the scattering matrix method?
No.
Is it Scott's Musical Museum?
You Googled it.
Unlikely. Is it the Science Museum of Minnesota? Oh, no.
I'm thinking there's
the
memory.
The Shanghai Metals Market?
No,
it wouldn't be that.
No, no.
How about single molecule magnets?
That's it?
Unlikely.
No.
Single monthly mortality, which actually turns out to be a measurement of prepayment of loans? No. Social media marketing, of course not. Soft magnetic materials, nope. Solar maximum mission? Mm-mm. Stepwise mutation model? Well, no. How about storage modification machine? That's, we're getting warm. Or could it be system management mode?
Oh.
Yes, indeed.
Next time, can you turn the lights off and hold a flashlight under your chin if you're going to do this?
So it turns out, I read this PDF, his white paper, was blissfully short. The abstract took up about the first quarter of the first page. There's something that we've always had called the programmable interrupt controller, the PIC.
Yeah.
We've always had that. That's how x86s do interrupts, is that you have a whole bunch of wires of interrupt signals. And everybody remembers the painful days of the, like the XT and the PC, where you had IRQ8 and IRQ9 and COM0, or was it COM1? I don't remember what it was named. I think it was COM1 used IRQ4.
Right.
And COM2 used IRQ3.
And COM3 used IRQ4 again.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Right. And I do remember that the disk drive used IRQ10. Oh, no. Video was IRQ10. No, I'm confused because INT13. Well, there was interrupts and there was IRQs. Anyway, it was a mess, and you'd sort of run out of them. And there's some, as you noted, that you could share, and some that you couldn't.
Conflicts were the bane of my existence for 10 whole years.
But boy, if you were doing the tech guy back then, Leo,
when I say bane of my existence, I mean calls.
I'm trying. I'm having trouble. My modem's on COM 1, and I've got a mouse on COM 3, and they don't seem to work.
Well, you've got an interrupt conflict, my friend.
I move the mouse, and the phone goes out.
So, as we evolved, we got the APIC, the Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller. And in order to, and so the Intel architecture has both I/O ports and lots of memory, as we know. It turns out that reading and writing to I/O ports is inconvenient for the operating system. It's easier if it's just in memory. And so, for example, video, the original video display was memory mapped, meaning that the processor would write to memory addresses, and that was actually performing essentially an I/O operation to hardware on the display adapter where the video memory resided. Similarly, the Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller, it had some I/O where you could use input and output instructions, but they're very crude on the Intel system. So instead, they memory map this Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller, so the operating system can just see it as a range of memory, and it is a 4K page, which can, for convenience sake, can be placed anywhere within the 32-bit address space, the 4.3 billion addresses. It needs to be aligned on a 4K boundary, so it's 4K, a 4K page that can exist on any 4K block of memory within the 4.3 gigabyte region. So there's something else called system management mode, and it too is memory mapped, and it can only be accessed from ring zero. That is the most privileged ring of the operating system. And that's also true of the Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller. Both of these things can only be accessed through ring zero. It turns out that it is possible until Sandy Bridge. So Sandy Bridge happened. That was the microarchitecture we got starting in 2011. So 4 years ago, Intel realized this was a problem, and they fixed it. So this is really no longer a problem for anyone. So, but for in 2010 and earlier, from like 1997 to 2010, it was possible to deliberately program the Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller so that its memory mapping overlaid the system management mode memory mapping. And if the two collided, reads that were being attempted to be made from system management mode would come back as zero, and writes would be intercepted by the APIC and would not penetrate, would not get through to system management mode. So what this guy figured out was, if you like really had to, and you already had OS level ring zero privilege, there was a way to exploit until Sandy Bridge the fact that these two things were memory mapped, and that the APIC, the Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller, took priority. That is, if these regions of memory were colliding, the system gave priority to the APIC. And so he figured out a way to use that interaction so that the system management mode would not receive the instructions it was supposed to. They would be blocked by the programmable interrupt controller. And if you also knew exactly what code was where in this particular motherboard's system management mode memory, and they all differ by motherboard version and make and model and an update level, so it's completely impractical, then it was possible to, if you already had root privileges, to modify the firmware to install a rootkit in the system management mode memory. And that's what it was. So it was like, okay, well, fine. The sky is not falling. Mm. Life has not ended as we know it. You already have to have the kind of privilege that would allow you to install a rootkit in the system. But this allows you, if you know enough about the hardware you're trying to install it on, to essentially to push a rootkit down into the firmware through this little hole, if like everything lines up just exactly right. And as I mentioned, we talked about this on the new screensavers on Saturday, and I referred to it as like, you know, if you were hopping on your right foot during a blue moon and everything lined up perfectly, then maybe this would work for you. But it's like, okay, you know, a perfect example of, you know, somebody really, I mean, the description was more fun than anything else. So nothing to worry about here. Nothing to see.
It's almost as if they make money if more people show up for their talk. Like, they're really selling the talk.
Well, and nobody disputes that this was a very clever hack. Nobody would have ever thought about it, but nobody could ever has or actually could ever use it either.
Right.
So it's like, okay.
Yeah. All right, nice.
Now, I know you're a fan, Leo, of Push Bullet.
Yeah, I use it.
And I haven't quite figured out how to use it, but I want to, because I'm sort of straddling ecosystems. You know, I'm not completely in iOS, although I have an iOS phone and iPads, and it would be nice to get them to communicate into my Windows environment or my browsers. And as I understand it, it's able to do that.
Push Bullet's available on iOS. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I thought it was an Android only.
Yep, okay. It is on iOS. Anyway, the news is that they just added something that had been much requested. And so for any of our other push bullet users, they now add end-to-end encryption.
Oh, nice.
So, yes, so that is nice. You need to give each of your push bullet instances a password. And so, you know, the moment I heard end-to-end encryption, it's like, whoops, wait a minute. If you don't also have authentication, then we know you could suffer a man-in-the-middle attack. So that really wouldn't buy you any security. The good news is they did it right. First of all, I did some follow-up research, and the guys at Push Bullet were saying, well, wait a minute, you know, don't you? If you trust us, then you don't need end-to-end encryption. And if you don't trust us, then you shouldn't be using this anyway, because who's to say we didn't bury something?
Yeah,
exactly. Which, of course, is always the dilemma. But the people that wanted this, and there was some dialogue over on Reddit, explained that it's not Push Bullet we don't trust. It's anybody else listening to the traffic. And that was the problem, that all of the Push Bullet traffic, even though it was, and the Push Bullet traffic was over SSL, so it was secure anyway. But if you allow that SSL might be vulnerable, there was no inner encryption inside the SSL tunnel to protect the push bullet traffic. Now there can be. So anyone using push bullet, as of, I think it's just like this just happened, like today or yesterday. Actually, it's dated. It was an article in Android Police dated today, 8/11, saying that push bullet now supports end-to-end encryption. for notification mirroring, SMS and copy and paste, and sync. So it's various features. You need to give it a good, strong password, and it uses that to generate a symmetric 256-bit key so to encrypt the tunnel. So all of your various instances at each end will need the same key, but when they have that, then you really do have strong encryption of the stuff that you're pushing back and forth. So I wanted to let everybody know that was now there. Cool. So update your copies of push bulletin.
Yes.
Okay, now this is bizarre. Or, in fact, it's so bizarre that security people didn't believe it. Oracle's chief security officer, a woman named Mary Ann Davidson, posted something on her Oracle security blog, which caused the security researcher, who we've spoken of often, Matt Blaze, to assume that Oracle had been hacked, and it would this was posted as a parody. He tweeted. He said his first tweet was, "My first assumption after reading this was that Oracle's web server was hacked, and this article was a parody." And then he tweeted, "Oracle should get an honorary membership in the Locksmithing Guild for their heroic security by not looking policy." and it has since been pulled by Oracle, and Oracle has apologized.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah. Although you can see it on the Wayback Machine if you.
Yes, it has been so captured. It's been archived. So essentially, this Mary Ann Davidson, and reading this really is interesting because I don't know the person, and I don't want to make any disparaging assumptions, but. Wow, it's difficult to understand what frame of mind Oracle's chief of security officer must have to have truly said these things. So, for example, essentially what this came down to was she was threatening anyone who did a security analysis of Oracle's intellectual property, Oracle's code, as with breach of license, and complaining that people were doing a static code analysis and finding problems with Oracle software and reporting it. So, among other things in her blog, she said, "I want to reiterate that customers should not and must not," and those are in caps, capital S should, capital N not, and capital M must, and capital N not, "reverse engineer our code. However," she writes, "if there is an actual security vulnerability, we will fix it. We may not like how it was found, but we aren't going to ignore a real problem. That would be a disservice to our customers. We will, however, fix it to protect all our customers, meaning everybody will get the fix at the same time. However, we will not give a customer reporting such an issue that they found through reverse engineering a special one-off patch for the problem. We will also not provide credit in any advisories we might issue. You can't really expect us to say thank you for breaking the license agreement." And then she said elsewhere, but in the same blog post, "If we determine as part of our analysis that scan results could only have come from reverse engineering, or," she says, "in at least one case, because the report said cleverly enough, quote, static analysis of Oracle blank, whatever the product was, we send a letter to the sinning, and she used the word sinning, to the sinning customer, and a different letter to the sinning consultant who was acting on behalf of customer, reminding them both of the terms of the Oracle license agreement that preclude any reverse engineering. And then she ends with, again, all caps, so please stop it already. Unbelievable. So anyway, and I'll remind everybody that this is the company who brought us Java.
Yeah.
You know, the most ridiculously security vulnerability breach filled nightmare on the web for a decade, which has really only no longer a problem because kicking and screaming, they finally basically gave up. And I mean, and there are still companies that absolutely require that Java be accessible in browsers. But fortunately, most people outside of a corporate environment are no longer running Java. And of course, you know, Brian Krebs' advice and ours for years has been, you do not need it. You should not have it. Just, you know, don't patch it, remove it. And, you know, this company is saying that they're unhappy with the fact that people are now inspecting their code for problems and finding problems. They're saying, you should not be looking at our code. That is a breach of our intellectual property. It's like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
You know, this just says, stop using Oracle stuff. And it generated such an uproar within the security community that they removed the blog posting. The link now gives you a 404 error. It was captured by several different archiving sites just to say, whoa, okay, look, consider what this, I mean, what must, this is not some random unofficial person. This is the head of security at Oracle. Posting this.
Amazing.
And saying, don't look at our code. Bad. And if you do, well, yes, we'll fix it, but then we're not giving you, you know, any patches or credit or anything. Wow. Meanwhile, the EFF has released their version 1.0 of a product I think, Leo, you'll be able to get behind.
I installed
because
it.
This is not an ad blocker.
Yeah, I installed it immediately.
Good. This is Privacy Badger.
Although it could be kind of used as an ad blocker. It works
well,
as an ad blocker.
Yeah, and we're going to go into this. I think this is, actually there's something you can do that I think you probably will do, Leo.
Okay.
And that is they have sort of in concert with this, the EFF and a bunch of others. Let's see, Disconnect, Medium, Pixpanel, AdBlock, and DuckDuckGo all have produced a do not track policy document. And you can, you should, because you are not tracking. You know, twit.tv is not a tracking site. You can put this policy document on your server, and Privacy Badger will see it and then understand that you're not a tracking site. Anyway, so let me back
up
a little bit.
Okay, but let me show you the tracking that's on our site. And in response to that, they identify four trackers. Google Analytics, they say, is a tracker. We of course use that to measure traffic. Ad services is an ad. That's what serves there's two banner ads on our page. That's what serves them. Fonts are Google typefaces, and New Relic is a monitoring system that warns us if our server's down. So while the Google Ad Services is certainly tracking, these others, I mean, are tracking, but only in some sort of non-commercial sense, And that's the problem with a tool like this, is it doesn't really distinguish between, you know. I mean, and then it does say all these things are not tracking. So I don't.
Let me explain what they say it is.
Yeah.
And again, this is just released, so we need to get some experience with it. So they said, EFF is excited to announce that today we're releasing version 1.0 of Privacy Badger for Chrome and Firefox. Privacy Badger is a browser extension that automatically blocks hidden trackers that would otherwise spy on your browsing habits as you surf the web. As you browse the web, Privacy Badger looks at any third-party domains that are loaded on a given site and determines whether or not they appear to be tracking you. In other words, setting cookies that could be used for tracking or fingerprinting your browser. If the same third-party domain appears to be tracking you on three or more different websites, Privacy Badger will conclude that the third-party domain is a tracker and block future connections to it. For certain websites, if Privacy Badger were to block an embedded domain entirely, it would break the site's core functionality. For example, if Privacy Badger were to block licensebuttons.net, Creative Commons buttons would no longer load. In these cases, Privacy Badger blocks the domain from setting or receiving cookies or referrer headers, but allows the embedded content to load. So it's not, it's not just a black and white block everything indiscriminately tool. And then they said, to be clear, EFF isn't against websites seeking to build businesses around advertising. More business models means a more vibrant web. But advertising cannot come at the expense of user privacy and the inviolable principle of consent. Until the online tracking industry changes its ways, the only options for users is to protect themselves by installing tools such as Privacy Badger. Privacy Badger 1.0, they say, works in tandem with the new Do Not Track policy announced earlier this week by EFF, Disconnect, Medium, Mixpanel, Adblock, and DuckDuckGo. Installing Privacy Badger also enables the DNT flag as a clear signal to sites that the user wants to opt out of online tracking. Privacy Badger inspects third-party sites for a commitment to honor that request under the DNT policy. And this is that document I mentioned again a second ago. It says, if it finds one, it will unblock that third party by default. That way, web services that do the right thing by users can continue to collect anonymous data or show anonymous ads, while those that don't will be foiled by Badger's protections. So what they're saying is they do have what essentially is a conduct pledge. And you can see it at EFF.org/DNT-policy. And that's a pledge which companies can put on their server, which Privacy Badger will see and essentially negotiate, essentially say, okay, these people are pledging to honor user privacy. We're going to consider that they're not tracking, even though it does allow for this pledge allows for the anonymous collection of data. And of course we know that the EFF tends to tends to be very proactive about these sorts of things. But for me, you know, we know that I've been a proponent of the DNT header. And that just if users want to say, I don't want to be tracked, then the browser ought to be able to transmit that to sites saying, you know, I'm asserting that I don't want to be tracked. The problem, of course, is that it's just based fixed on the honor system. There's no way to enforce not tracking unless we block content. So, I mean, I think we're in a situation where we need sort of a negotiated solution. We need something where users can feel that their privacy is being respected, while a business model can continue to survive that generates ad revenue for showing people ads. And then the question is, I guess really the issue is the tracking side. I have no problem seeing ads, but there's the argument being made that databases are being aggregated in order to improve the quality of the ads being seen, and that makes some people uncomfortable. So
then they should stop going to the sites instead of telling me how to run my business. You don't know. No one knows whether. By the way, just in case you're wondering, 41% the use of ad blockers is up 41% in the last 12 months. And a study by PageFair and Adobe says that costs publishers $21.8 billion in ad revenue. That's all I'm going to say. Wow. It doesn't cost me anything. Yeah. That's not where we make our money.
Well, but, and remember, too, that it was at TechCrunch? I think it was at TechCrunch where I found the blog posting from the founder who said, we're really being hurt by this, folks. We're offering free content,
They probably shouldn't say free. Just no dollars or exchange. But we're offering you content,
sponsored content,
ad sponsored content, and yep. I mean, you look at GigaOm going away. You look at the sites shutting down. Yeah. It's just going to accelerate. It doesn't really affect our podcasts, but I worry that there's not going to be any news sites to report.
Well, don't you also feel it's a little bit like what we've gotten into is an arms race?
Yeah.
Because, for example, I go to sites and a huge pop-up comes up that blocks the entire page. And it's like, okay, fine. And then I have, and if I'm on a pad and I've already zoomed in, then I have to zoom out, find the close button the close X in the upper right hand corner.
I understand it's annoying. Then you shouldn't visit that site.
But I don't know that until I go there.
Well,
following links.
Don't go back. So the way to handle that is not to visit sites that offend you with their ad policies. I understand the real issue is invisible tracking. You don't know what's going on. I mean, a big takeover ad. If you don't like that, just don't go to the site. But what we need things like Privacy Badger for is to let us know what's behind the scenes.
Do you think that a big takeover is effective? I mean, is anyone looking at that and going, "Oh wow, I did need that"? I mean, isn't it just
I think probably
a pure
it is.
Annoyance?
I don't think I agree, but I don't think people would do it if it weren't effective. The real problem is nobody sees banner ads at all. I tried to not have banner ads on our website. I didn't want to have because I knew we'd have this conversation. And I know people I got an email from people who said, "I'm never going to listen to your podcast again because you have trackers on your website." And we use those banner ads as value added to sell podcast ads. It's part of our business model. I feel like these systems are imposing an arbitrary business model on a site because you don't like the business model. But that's not kind of how it works. You don't go in a store and say, you shouldn't be selling shoes because you just don't go to the store anymore.
Yeah, and from a technology standpoint, the trouble is users do have the ability,
right,
with the technology to block the retrieval of third party ads. The only way I can see this works is if these become first party ads. That is, if the site itself serves them rather than bouncing the user's browser.
Again, your decision about how a business model should run. The reason it's not done that way is because advertisers want to, at least, at the very least, they probably want information, but want to count it themselves.
Right.
I can say, hey, a million people saw your ad. They want to know. They want to count it themselves. At the very least, they want that.
Right.
And yeah, you can't blame them for that.
I think we have a tension. There is tension here between what users want and this ad-based model. The problem is the ad-based model is not able to force people due to the technology of the browser and server, is not able to force people to view content. I guess
you
want to
know why you see
is,
so much honey boo boo on network television.
Yeah, well,
you
want to
know?
I don't know.
When why True Detective's on pay television? Because the ads don't work, so they have to do cheaper and cheaper, crappier and crappier programming.
Boy,
aimed at people who can't figure out how to TiVo and fast forward.
Yeah,
that's why you're gonna see why you see more American Idol stuff and why they really focus on live. Because people are skipping ads.
Yeah.
I figure I'll be out of this business before it really crashes. I'm hoping.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how it evolves because, so ad blockers, if ad blockers are being adopted by that level, by that percentage of people, I don't believe there's that percentage of people that even are aware of tracking at all. It must be annoyance. The ads got too abusive.
Probably.
And so people looked for a recourse.
I would get that's most ad blocking. Yep.
Yeah.
It's annoying.
And so, this is the problem is that, and remember that phase when ads were flash based and stuff was jumping around?
I don't know if it's in your rundown, but Yahoo was serving malware last week.
Yes.
On flash based.
Right. I forgot to get that in the notes. Yes.
Black well, you know, it's half so much now. It's like 100, according to this study, and it's from Adobe. I don't know. 198 million monthly active users are running. We're running major browser ad blocking extensions as of June. 198 million.
Yeah.
See, mostly in Oregon. 45 million are in the U.S. So it's a small number compared to the total number, but it's growing fast. That's the cause for concern. Oregon has the highest ad blocking rate in the country, 16.4%. Washington, D.C., half that.
Interesting. I wonder, if the Oregon newspaper, if the Oregon web-based newspaper has particularly annoying ads.
Maybe. Could
something
be.
Like that. But
it's probably a higher percentage of technically sophisticated people, frankly. I would guess.
So my point is that we know that, the volume gets turned up on ads on television, even though there's now legislation that says it's illegal to do that. I watch it happen. Ads are desperate to get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, web-based ads, they're using animation and distraction. I mean, they want to distract us, and we don't want to be distracted. So really, the way to solve the problem is for the advertisers to back off and recognize there is a limit to how distracting they can be before users are driven to find a solution. And the fact is, a solution exists called ad blocking.
Right.
You know, your banner ad. Or not. I mean, I had to look for them, Leo. I couldn't even find them.
I know. That was the compromise. I said, I don't want banner ads. Lisa said, we have to have banner ads. It's like $1 million a year difference. I said, not from the ads alone, but the value that they provide to our ad sales. And I said, well, and we negotiated down to two in a fairly unobtrusive ad. And actually, as it turns out, we can't sell the bottom ad. So that's
I had to. I had to look for them.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, they're completely innocuous.
Yeah.
Well.
We all get hurt by the obnoxious ads, but, you know.
Right. I think that's exactly it.
Yeah. That's all right.
And in fact, that's sort of what Adblock Plus, that was their deal.
Yeah.
Was what they had if your ads are not annoying, then we're going to let them through.
They had an approved ad policy, but you could also pay them.
Right. And that's the problem is that they wanted to make some money too. And so then it became a racketeering.
Well, I would be just as happy to have everything we do behind a paywall. But it has some negative impacts. First of all, it's undemocratic if you can't afford to watch our stuff because you don't have a buck a show or $5 a month. That leaves you out in the cold, and I want everybody to be able to see this. Also, I found in our early years, as you might remember, we asked for you were the first show to have ads, by the way. Mm-hmm. We asked for donations, and it was fine, but it was enough for one person to kind of make a living.
Right. Right. And, you know, one of the things that could work, a model that could work, if we ever get a micropayments system in place, because, for example, sometimes I follow a link to the New York Times, which is behind a paywall.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it doesn't matter. Sometimes it does.
Right.
And I remember, and this happened like last week, you've already seen five things this month.
Right.
So subscribe or die. And they show me enough of the whatever it was that I want the whole thing. If there were a micropayment scheme, I would press a button for them to have a penny or whatever they want from me. I mean, they could show me, you know, if you want to read this, it'll cost you 2 cents. I think, yeah, I want it. It's worth 2 cents to me. Bang. Now I have access to it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's where we're going to have to end up getting is a system like that.
I don't know what the answer is.
I don't know. So for anyone who is wondering if we've had enough time bashing all kinds of exploits so far, there is a new version today of Flash. I didn't even bother digging into what nightmares they had solved, but I was running an older one. It's now at version 18.0.0.232. So 18.00.232. And you can go to adobe.com/software/flash/about, and hopefully your browser won't run it. It'll require you to click on something to like permit that, because the Adobe's version checker, their Flash about thing is itself Flash, which a secure browser will not run by default. So hopefully. And let's see. A miscellaneous question. Many people have asked this, and I finally was moved to put it into the notes. A couple of people tweeted, how do I clean my Contigo thermos? You know how everyone has seen my thermos that I use. And boy, after a year or two, it looks like what's that stuff that's absolutely black?
Ebony? Ivory.
There's a term for like a matte black finish, which is just like no light bounces
ice.
From. Anyway, it's you look in it and it's just black. Anyway, the point is there is an amazing cleaner, and it's called PuroCaff, PuroCaff, two words. Amazon carries it. I found it at Starbucks. It's what Starbucks uses for like dealing with their own coffee stuff.
Yeah, we are going to get our Temp Perfect mug one day.
Yeah, I know. I get email every month or two. We're still at it, you know. And it's like, okay, well, yeah. Anyway, so for what it's worth, if anybody is seeing like the inside of their anything that contains coffee is really looking scary, PuroCaff, PuroCaff. It is freaky how well it works.
I'll have to get
you put like a tablespoon in the bottom and fill it up with hot water, and it fizzes. It's like kind of a Vesuvius sort of thing. And it just sort of let it sit for a couple hours. And then when you pour the water out, it's all brown, and it leaves pure silver behind. It's just incredible how well it works.
Now, I had a screensavers mug that over 20 years or whatever got pretty well stained. It was a ceramic mug. And Lisa said, oh, no problem. Just put some crushed ice and salt and water in there and and leave it. And so, and I'm thinking, and it did, it worked. It's like it bleached it. So I'm wondering if maybe there's salts. Well, that does look good.
We're looking at Steve's
perfect.
That is after I did it, and it was black. It looked like the heart of darkness. Like before, wow. And it's like zero effort. You just put a tablespoon of that stuff in there, and it's like shiny and brand new.
It's not
again.
Poison.
So, no, and it can't be because it's meant to be.
Sure,
going
it
where
be poison.
Could not be poison. No, I mean, I would rinse it thoroughly because it's scary. It's scary stuff, but boy, does it do the job.
I'm getting some right now. Couldn't be poison.
Oh, and I did want to mention that next week is the finale of the first season of a show that has been renewed on AMC. I've referred to it a couple times. It has ended up being so good. It gets top recommendation, and that's Humans. Humans on
Humans.
Humans. It's about things that are not. Oh. It's sort of a near future. They're not trying to pretend that all their cars are like, you know, whining with a turbo sounding engine. They're just normal. It's a British production. But it's in a world where there are synthetic humans, which are produced as sort of helpers, clerical workers and crossing guards and things. And they're not much fun at a party, but no. That way. They're kind of flat. They have no affect, except there are some that are different.
Uh-oh.
And it's been a really good first season. So for anyone who is looking for a series that's worthwhile, I imagine you can find them online. Probably AMC will allow you to stream the back episodes. It's a slow burn. It's not like some ripping, roaring action. I wasn't sure if it was going to really evolve. But I've ended up being very satisfied with it. So I did want to give everybody a heads up there. Following sci-fi as I do.
I love our chat room. I prefer the original Swedish version, Kataminskur, from 2012. if you really like this, you should probably watch that.
Is it in English? Because I don't do subtitles.
No. Humans. And then Mr. Robot, did you decide? Good or bad?
It's interesting. Many people were put off by the drugginess of it.
Yeah.
I just think it's very good. Okay. I mean, I enjoy it.
I finally started watching Sense8, which you recommended. And that's
yes.
Really lush, gorgeously shot. Just beautiful.
Yes. Yeah. You're right. The photography is incredible.
It's a Netflix original. It's major motion picture quality. It's amazing.
Yep. And did get renewed.
Oh, good. I'm not,
for what
not
it's
through
worth,
with it yet.
This second season of True Detective was really something, too.
Did you like it?
Oh, it was dark.
A lot of people hated it.
I didn't mind it. I thought it was, I get why people wouldn't. I'm not recommending it for everyone, but
like the first season, beautifully shot.
Grit.
Fascinating acting, you know, really something to watch.
Real characterization.
But the worst real plotting character development I've ever seen. And it's like Nick Pizzolatto, who writes these, I really feel like he needs some work. He needs some plotting help.
Well, I got a nice note from Michael Coyne in Raleigh, Essex, UK. And this is not just a testimonial. This actually is a question sort of about Spinrite's ECC readout. He said, "Dear Steve, I'm no propeller head, but I really stay up on the security side of things, and I'm so glad I stumbled upon Security Now about 5 years ago. SpinRite increased the ECC maximum number on my old 250 gigabyte computer by about 5 points over several years, and it says on one of the GRC SpinRite pages, a 100% healthy drive shows no red. My old computer was certainly healthy in that respect. My 2 terabyte drive isn't quite as healthy, as I always see some red blocks on the ECC readout while SpinRite is working on the drive. And the seek error maximum has increased 3 points in the 6 months I've owned the computer. Best wishes, Michael Coyne. So I just wanted to respond to Michael's statement, essentially, to explain that, well, you know, unfortunately, as I've mentioned, drives are beginning to rely much more heavily on error correction than they were before. What is unique about SpinRite is that the smart data only reflects trouble the drive is having, and it only is going to have trouble when you're asking it to do something. So there are lots of smart monitors around that will show you what the drive's parameters are, but I would argue that only when you are putting the drive under stress and making it do lots of seeks and making it do lots of reads that then the ECC reading actually has some meaning, because SpinRite shows it to you in real time. You know, is the drive correcting more than it thinks it should? Those red dots are the health rating from the drive itself, which is different than the raw error correction count, which SpinRite also shows. But here, though, as those red blocks appear, this is the drive saying, I'm correcting more than I'm thinking I should be. So you don't normally ever see those when the drive is operating. It's only under SpinRite where we're just saying read, 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 read. And the drive is beginning to say, oh, I'm seeing a little more error correction than my own designers thought was healthy for me. So it is something worthwhile keeping an eye on over time, because as drives get older, they can have increasing problems reading back what they wrote before. And again, that only SpinRite shows it to you.
It's a good point that you've got to stress it before it'll show.
Right.
Information right. About it.
Just like us.
Just like the time people. We sleep.
Okay, so finally, the quest for surfing safety. Everybody knows that I've been a huge proponent of just say no to script, to JavaScript, to scripting. That, unfortunately, scripting lies at the heart of both the functionality of the web we're using today and the anti-functionality, the malicious functionality of all the vulnerabilities that we see. Even when the actual problem is in Flash or in Java, it's scripting which is invoking these problems typically. Not necessarily, but it generally is the way it happens. Or it's scripting itself that is the problem. So the point is that disabling scripting has been demonstrated to be a far safer way to function. As I mentioned last week, I've given up. I'm spending so much time permitting scripting of all the crazy number of assets that sites are beginning to require. It used to be one or two different places that a site would also need to have scripting enabled. Now it's 30, And you know, and NoScript just shows this long list of things, and you enable a few things, and then the list grows because those things that you've enabled are now wanting to use their own, and technically it's fourth-party sources that they're relying on. So then the list expands, and finally it's like, okay, forget it. This is, I mean, I need a different solution. So then I thought, okay, what about going back to Sandboxy? The problem is I was brought up a little bit short by this vulnerability that I talked about this week in Firefox, because this was a script. Okay, so it's true. If I were still using NoScript and I was on that Russian site that was trying to serve me a Russian ad that was using scripting, NoScript would have protected me. But if scripting were enabled, Sandboxy would not, because what Sandboxy does is it allows reads from the system, assuming that those are safe, but it sandboxes writes so that any writing, any modification to the OS will go into the sandbox, where they are subsequently read from, assuming that you need some interaction, but the writes do not get pushed out of the sandbox to the OS. Well, obviously, if you had some evil script that was exfiltrating files on your system, Sandboxy doesn't solve the problem. So I think the solution for safe surfing is for us collectively, us, the Security Now community. And there is a community. We have a community of listeners. We've got people submitting all kinds of ideas and questions through the Security Now mailbag. And, of course, I have an active Twitter following that is tweeting me lots of stuff going on. I think what we need to find is a small and lightweight OS that can run in a virtual machine where we can run the browser of our choice. I choose Firefox. Some people are choosing Chrome. And I think
there is a Firefox OS, isn't there?
Yeah.
Like there's a Chrome OS?
Well, but those are standalone. Now maybe the Firefox OS would run very small in a VM. That's certainly something to look at. I've invested no time in this because my focus is full. My full-time focus when I'm not producing the podcast is on Squirrel. And we've had I haven't talked about Squirrel for a couple of weeks, but there's been some really great forward motion. About several months ago, I did mention that during a bunch of brainstorming, I came up with the kernel of an idea that we collectively honed into something really workable in the GRC news group, and have come up with a solution that makes Squirrel absolutely and completely unspoofable, which was one of the early problems that was recognized. Was there was some concern about Squirrel's spoofability, and we'll get into that sometime when we're talking about the technology of it. But anyway, my focus is still there. But I found something called Tiny Core Linux, which is as small as about 15 megabytes, and it looks like it runs Firefox. And so if I could be running my web browser in a VM, then I think that's the right way to go. Then it could be unfettered. I wouldn't worry about ads.
That's the ultimate sandbox.
Exactly. The ultimate sandbox. It can't see my OS. It can't write. It's an OS running with full isolation.
And you refresh it each time, right? So it starts from scratch each time, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So that way all cookies are blasted. Super cookies are meaningless.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think your IP address won't change.
No, but IP address is real soft tracking material. It's not, I mean, it's true that it is relatively static. publicly. But I'm more concerned. I'm much less concerned about tracking than I am about malicious content. So, I mean, that's why I was running with no script. It was never ads I wanted to block. Right. It was scripting that was right. just too prone to problems. And I think that's what we need. So, you know,
here's another,
browsers.
Something the chat room's passed along, Menuet OS.
Yep, I know about Menuet. I know about Menuet.
It's not a Linux, but it is a Unix. Actually, no, it's not based on POSIX. It's its own thing.
Huh. Yeah, the question is, does it have a state-of-the-art browser? We need it to be able to run, really, either Chrome or Firefox. I mean, I don't want to run IE. There's no reason to when we have, you know, something that's much more feature-rich and plug-inable. But I think that's
showing a browser on a screenshot, but who knows what it is. I'll have to
I'll put it out to my listeners because we've got, super capable listeners. Let's think about, sort of as a communal project, a small VM, because we don't want to burn up RAM, that all it has to do is run a browser, Firefox or Chrome. I think it ought to be Linux, because I think Linux is going to be smaller than anything else. And Chrome and Firefox are both available for Linux. So I think that's the right solution.
Here's another one. Chat room's been great on this one. Tails. It's called the Amnesic Incognito Live System. TAILS.
It's a that all live, sounds good.
Live operating system, runs from DVD, USB, or SD. I'll have to see what... I don't know what it is. Oh, it's Debian. So you could run Chromium on it then.
Yeah, now there again, there you'd be rebooting your system to run
it. Because it runs through Tor.
Yeah, so we really want something that is small, that runs in a VM, that will run in VMware or what's the free one? I'm blanking on the name.
Yeah,
anyway,
I always get it wrong.
Everybody knows.
I always say OneDrive. Yeah. It's the one from, sad to say, Oracle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. But hopefully they have messed it up. Well, we are at the end of our 520th episode.
Wowie, wowie, wowie.
We have done 10 years. Our first episode, episode one, was, and I'll forever regret not numbering episode zero, but, you know,
I'm sure we did. There was an episode zero of Twit, you know, so I'm sure there was an episode zero in some way.
Well,
we probably
August
recorded
19th.
It on the set.
August 19th, 2005.
Wow.
And here we are on the 11th. So next week will be the 18th, meaning that this really is, this is the end of year 10.
Wow.
And we'll be starting into year 11.
Wow.
Right on the episode number that we would expect on 521. So I want to, again, thank you, Leo, for making this possible for me and our listeners, for creating just a great podcast. I love the interaction that we have now with the mailbag and with Twitter. I feel a real sense of community. And, it's been 10 years.
We looked a lot younger back then.
Oh, my Lord.
Actually, this is the old screensaver show, but same
idea. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's 10 great years, Steve. I really cherish our friendship and value the show. It's, you know, easily the geekiest show we do on Twit, most hardcore. And, you know, almost not a week goes by where somebody, including me, doesn't say, got to find out what Steve Gibson thinks about that.
Well, so. And I do know from Jeff. Jeff, during New Year's, I was chatting with him on the New Year's Eve show, and he said that for the last couple of years, at least, we've seen constant growth.
Yeah.
That Security Now's been a steadily growing podcast.
It's done very, very well. Yeah. I think it went up 60%. What was it? 18% this year. And it's just, very steady growth, as it should be, because the world's getting more dangerous. We need you more.
Well, and it means that while we are going to see some churn of our listeners, in general, people are finding value here and they're staying for more. So,
Again,
I really thank our listeners for their support and loyalty.
Here's to 10 more, okay?
Absolutely.
After that, all bets are off.
I don't think that we're going to run out of things to talk about. There's no sign of that happening.
Great to have you. We do Security Now Tuesdays. If you got to know, what would Steve say about this? You've got to tune in Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC on twit.tv. You can also pick up episodes at grc.com. That's Steve's website. That's where you'll find SpinRight, the world's finest hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You'll also find lots of freebies, lots of information, 16 kilobit versions of the show if you're really bandwidth impaired, great transcripts, show notes, everything's there. And that's the place to go to ask questions, because we might be able to get a question and an answer episode in next week. I don't know. Crossing our fingers.
I think. Let's hope.
Go to grc.com/feedback, or you can query Steve on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at SGGRC.
I noticed that my Twitter follower, I hadn't looked at my count for a while. It's getting close. It's a 49-something. So
that's good.
50,000. So
that's pretty significant. Yeah.
Getting there. Yeah.
In fact, I think we could give it a little boost if everybody who listens to this show would now go follow at SGGRC. I think we could get it into the six figures here.
I meant to say that on Saturday. I forgot on your new screensavers, because that's a somewhat different audience.
Yes.
And so what I'm, yes, you know, that would be the key, because I'm sure everyone who is listening to this who's also on Twitter is already following me. So
I would hope so.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Why not? All right, Steve. Have a great week. Congratulations on 10.
Thank you, my friend.
10 more to come.
Hey, congratulations to us. You took a dream and you've built a network. I mean, something really substantial, Leo. So good going.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, buddy. Security Now.